The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dr. Ken Blank. I'm an affiliated assistant professor of neurosurgery at Loyola University Medical Center, and I specialize in biomechanics and biologics, and I'm here with my colleagues.
Hi, everyone. My name is Zori Boozer. I'm a director of research and regenerative medicine at Gerling Institute and research assistant professor at the Department of Orthopedic Surgery, NYU.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gene Techmeister. I'm an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at Keck Medicine of USC. My specialty is interventional spine and regenerative medicine as well as sports medicine.
So today's topic is going to be regenerative intradiscal treatments and therapies. And I'd like to start off with asking each of you if you can define that broad category there in your own terms.
I don't think there's really a strict definition. It's pretty much anything that we can inject intradiscal. The regenerative adds a little bit of a caveat, meaning that it is thought to make the tissues regenerate. But we know we've tried injecting substances into the disc for as long as I can remember, trying to undo the degenerative cascade and really prevent or treat degenerative disc disease and axial low back pain because of a discogenic phenomenon.
I do agree, and I think when we think about regenerative therapies and what we are trying to inject, we have to take a step back and first think about the patient population. Who is the right patient? Are we talking about the aging spine and are going through that whole cascade that maybe in patients who are 70 years old have lasted for 40 years, in which stage we are trying, or are we more focusing, I don't want to necessarily say younger population, but degenerative disc. And you, Gene, you mentioned low back pain. Mm-hmm. Are we talking discogenic pain? Are we looking at end plates? Because there is definitely that part as well. Does the pain come from the end plates and it's vertebrogenic pain? So as we talk about regenerative technologies, we have to really consider population. My question for you guys is actually, what do you think about imaging modalities? Because how do we, to define what disc to inject and what to inject, we first have to look at, we have to have some type of a imaging to support that.
No, of course, I think the challenge when treating discogenic back pain, and I think this has been covered in some of the symposium here before, and this can be a topic all on its own, but how do you actually diagnose discogenic pain? The gold standard has always been considered to be discography, but we know that there is provocative and anesthetic discography, and there's limitations with that. Recently, with the advent of vasovertebral nerve ablation and treatments that are designed to treat end plate pain, MODIC 1 and MODIC 2 changes in the radiographic model can help determine what and where we treat, but not necessarily do we treat every MODIC change. Mm-hmm. We have to correlate to a patient population. Just because somebody presents with low back pain to an office and they have MODIC changes does not necessarily mean it's an end plate problem. You have to separate into anterior column and posterior column. So mm-hmm. before we even really dive into the biologics or interventional procedures, really have to make sure that our diagnosis is correct. And Zori alluded to earlier, it's the right patient, the right time, and the right diagnosis. If you don't have the correct diagnosis, so it's nonspecific, that's going to lead to nonspecific treatment. And I think we're not where we need to be yet in really identifying what we are treating. Is it end plate? Is it vertebral degeneration? Is it discogenic degeneration? Is it an annular tear? Is it a herniation that is causing the low back pain and axial pain without radiating symptoms? So that brings up the good point, is really need to be as focused as we can.
So my next question is, based on the evidence, how efficacious are intradiscal regenerative treatments and therapies, and what are we allowed to do based on FDA guidelines?
Maybe I can start with it.
Absolutely.
So I think we've all, even here at our NASS annual meetings and as a biologics committee, we every year have annual biologics meeting where we discuss various therapies for disc regeneration. And what we've known as within the society and within our previous research efforts and with other societies is that when it comes to regenerative therapies, evidence is low. If you're talking about stem cells or cell type therapies, I will just classify them as growth factor therapies. When it comes to some growth factor therapies, I believe that just based on the limited evidence, we sometimes struggle even with protocols. Mm. Not necessarily, we haven't even answered to Gene's point, as we discussed, who is the right patient, but what is the right protocol, what is the concentration. When it comes to cells, very often a large number of cells is injected, and we know the disc is a cellular organ and avascular. So it's a very challenging environment for just even the cells that reside within the disc and not the external cells. And when it comes to stem cells, one of the beauties of stem cells is that they can differentiate in anything way, or most of the time. So if we expose them, my question always is, if we expose them to degenerative cascades, how do we know that they're gonna become either nucleus or annular cells and not just apoptotic cell, that it's also gonna continue producing pro-inflammatory cytokines?
A lot of great thoughts there, Dr. Tuckmeister.
Well, that's a great point. And just going back to your earlier question, Zuri mentioned, well, we're going to inject something into a disc. How do we actually make it do what we want it to do? Mm-hmm. How do we activate it? How do we culture it? The problem is the FDA gave guidelines in 2021 saying we can't do that outside of a clinical setting. It has to be autologous, same day, in the hospital, in the office. Nothing is added. Nothing is manipulated enzymatically or otherwise to create a product. The only thing we can really do is this minimal manipulation of centrifugation. Mm-hmm. So if you use these autologous PRP products, for example, platelet-rich plasma products, some concentrate it 2 or 3 times the normal platelet counts. Some will give you a 400, 800,000 platelet count yield. Some will give you more than 1 million because they're able to concentrate 5 to 6 times. From the peripheral musculoskeletal literature, we do know that some higher concentrations tend to work better for tendinopathies and tendon injuries. But does that really relate to treating an intradiscal problem? So if we're injecting something, what are we injecting? What is the cell count? Is it actually doing what we want it to do? Because we cannot manipulate it in any way outside of a clinical trial setting. Mm-hmm. And up to this point, I'm only aware of 2 randomized controlled clinical trials looking at intradiscal PRP injectates. And the evidence is okay. It's about 55 to 60% improvement overall, but we don't really have a good way of diagnosing in terms of proving that that's what's really treated. Now patients get better. Now, is it because they're having a procedure? Is it because the injected is actually effective? And I think that's still yet to be proven. But I think what we really need to take away is, what are we really able to do? And if you manipulate it in more than minimal fashion, as the FDA outlines, then we're really reaching into something that may be illegal. And we really have to be cognizant of being appropriate and doing things within the realm that we are allowed to do it.
Great. So my last question is, you know, what does the future look like for intradiscal regenerative therapies and treatments? And if there was one thing that you can recommend that we can do better or that we can look forward to, what would that be?
Oh, that's a tough
one. It's a big one. Yeah.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
I wish we could solve it today. I think throughout our conversation today, I think the 2 main points are truly to sit down as a spine community and find the best way to identify those patients. Consider their risk factors, consider the type of degenerative pathology that they have. Is it a single level? Are we talking 2 levels? That's one. And then the other one is to define the protocols, irrespective if we are talking about cell-based or graft-based, or maybe even with a scaffold, because scaffolds, we haven't discussed today, but scaffolds still do play a role, mm-hmm. especially if we are looking at a collapsed disc. And then are we just looking at a very low degeneration grade? At early onset, mm-hmm. are we preventing it, not regenerating? That is another big question that has been part of our community. So I think these would be, from my perspective, the 2 points.
Okay.
Do you think it's, just a question for Zora really quick, do you think it's more important to stop the progression of degeneration or reverse it? Mm-hmm. Or do you think we can even be at a place where we can reverse it, or stopping it enough to cause clinically significant outcome?
So based on a limited research and what I can remember, I think there was an article that tried to calculate that, like, how far can we go in regenerating versus stopping? And I think that they calculated that it would take at least 2 decades, if I remember the statistic, for stem cells to regenerate 25% of disc height. So again, it's probably a very heterogeneous patient population that was used for the analysis just because our evidence is low. So I think it's a fine line mm-hmm. in preventing, because again, disc is a very tough tissue. Mm-hmm. It's not a tissue that regenerates that quickly. Right. But I do believe that with right therapies and identifying right patients, we could probably do both.
I think to answer your initial question mm-hmm. is, how do we get the substrate that we want to have the action that we want? Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, the missing link here. It's like, okay, that's great. We can take a stem cell. We can take your blood. We can take an allograft from whatever cell culture or cell-based progenitor line that we can think of, but we can inject it anywhere. How do we actually have it create the action? Like, once it's in the tissues, what is the mechanism of activation of that cell line to create the cell lineage that you want to create regeneration, to restore disc height? And that may be the missing link mm-hmm. in my eyes. Because I think we are good in isolating some of these regenerative treatments. We can make growth factors, we can make cytokines, we can isolate them. But we can't get them to have the necessary action within the tissues, at least in vivo. And that's where I think the technology is lacking just as much as our scientific knowledge in terms of the true pathophysiology of how mm-hmm. a disc degrades.
I do actually have a quick follow-up question on that. So if we are looking at injecting a growth factor cell, obviously a lot of research has focused on lumbar spine. Mm-hmm. And in lumbar spine is biomechanically challenged in a very different way than cervical or thoracic, that it's very stable. So is there a need for a scaffold? Or because that goes back to identifying right patient, mm-hmm. because if a disc is 50% collapsed, and if we inject, and if there are annular tears, the first question is that gonna stick? Mm-hmm. So do we need to seal? Do we need to bring a scaffold that might not necessarily immediately increase the disc height, but help towards that? Because with the loading, what about adjacent segment disease then?
Well, I think if you look at some of the earlier data from some of the biologic injectables from 10 to 12 years ago, when I was mm-hmm. a fellow, we were part of the Biostat study. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, the fibrin gels and the glues and things like that. And the people that I thought were gonna do great ended up getting saline. And I'm like, well, this isn't really working now, is it? You know, the people that I thought were gonna be home runs and slam dunks that we injected when I was a fellow, looking back at the data, and they were all got saline. So I'm not sure if a scaffolding like a fibrin glue or gels is enough, because mm-hmm. obviously on its own, it's not working. Now, can you combine the treatments and the therapies? Now that's a different question, but now you're getting into the FDA territory of mm-hmm. now you're manipulating. Yeah. Now you're actually activating a substrate. You can't even add calcium carbonate to PRP when you're injecting it. So that has to be answered in the clinical trial setting.
Would you be able to give us one quick summary of those FDA guidelines one more time?
Sure. So PRP and bone marrow concentrates are only allowed to be performed as long as it's autologous, same day, with minimal manipulation, meaning centrifugation only. Nothing is added, nothing is subtracted. So even stromal vascular fraction is unable to be done beyond the office space. And amniotic products that are commercially available, that regulation is a little bit unclear. But essentially, you take out the substrate or the tissue, whether it's stem cells or PRP, and pretty much the only thing you can do is centrifugate it and then inject it. So the relevance and the validity and how well it functions is very, very limited.
Well, this was great. A lot of thinking points to move forward with. I'd like to thank you both for participating, and I believe that will be the end of it. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.